Hello and welcome to this month's Kosher Classes web conference, teleconference. We're broadcast to you from Starkey offices in Baltimore. Some people are joining us via web at dimdim.com, and we're also able to be joined by telephone at 218-895-1203, code 2020#. And that number is on the dim on the top. Also, if something happens to your computer, you can give us a ring. I'm Rabbi Tzvi Goldberg, and at my right is Rabbi David Heber.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Thank you for joining us again, Rabbi Heber. We are going to be discussing this month Rosh Hashanah issues, which is coming up fast and furious upon us in 2 weeks. Rosh Hashanah will be here on Thursday, and it's an early year this year. And another one of Rabbi Heber's expertise is calendar events. So maybe you could explain to us first, why is Rosh Hashanah so early this year? It's early, relatively.
Relatively early. Well, what happens is you have what we call the 19-year cycle, which is every 19 years the calendar, the Hebrew and English, get back to the same place where they were. During the course of those 19 years, there are 7 leap years. Leap years are typically late years, meaning the Yom Tovim, the holidays, fall out late in the year. Rosh Hashanah could even be in October, sometimes in a late year. Pesach could actually, the end of Pesach could be in May, in a very, very late leap year. What happens then is in the non-leap years, the Hebrew days within the English calendar start to drift a little bit earlier and earlier.
11 days
every year. So what happens is the earliest of those years are the years prior to leap years, which is what we're in.
So what is the earliest it could ever possibly be?
The earliest, I think, is
the
sixth, I believe.
How about in August? Can we have Rosh Hashanah in August?
No, not in this calendar. Hundreds of years ago. What happens is that it's the earliest 2 years after a leap year, which is the same as a year before a leap year. So there are 5 of the 19 years are the second year after a leap year, and therefore those 5 years are relatively early. We're actually in the third earliest possible year within the cycle, and that gets into every so often leap years are after 2 years instead of 3. So we're sort of moving away from that. And the bottom line is in 2013 will be the earliest of the 19-year cycle when the Rosh Hashanah will be 4 days earlier than it is this year. Just to illustrate how really early it'll be, Hanukkah, the first day of Hanukkah, will be on Thanksgiving in 2013.
Okay, we'll look for that.
Which just illustrates how early the Yom Tov will be.
So we're going to discuss Rosh Hashanah issues. Rabbi Heber has written an article for the Kashrus Currents, which is our quarterly publication, called To Be, I'm sorry, yeah. I was going to say To Be,
that was the old one.
Or Not To Be. Okay, this is called Do Be and Don't Be. Okay, A Kashrus Guide to Honey and Other Bee Derivatives. And the article goes through pretty in depth of the different bee products and which are kosher and which are not. And I actually thought I would start with something that's not in the article, and that is, we've discussed previously, something called black forest honey, right? Which is actually a non-kosher honey. It's not really honey. That's the insect.
Because
it comes from an insect.
Oh, it's off an insect.
Right.
I didn't really cover that, but really, I didn't touch
Sorry
on
to
it.
Put you on the spot.
No, I didn't even refer to the name that you were calling it. It's coming from a non-bee.
It's
a non-bee honey.
It's coming from a wasp. It's a secretion, and I think that the bees do eat it and then re-secrete it. But whatever it is, the source of it is not nectar. That's the bottom line.
So there is discussion about different insects that are there. I mean, technically, the Gemara Bechairis, which is the basis of the whole question, the Gemara which we do bring in the article, the Gemara Bechairis asks the question: why is honey kosher in the first place? It comes from a non-kosher species. Bees are non-kosher
right.
species, as all insects are strictly forbidden to eat. So if the bee is not kosher, what comes out of it, just by means of example, milk from a camel. Camel's milk is not kosher. That's why the whole takana, the whole establishment of Chol Yisrael was made, because they were afraid that maybe people, you know, the farmers put in, etc., etc. So we, that's just a classic example of where an item is not kosher because it's a yotzei min hatameh, which means it comes from a non-kosher species, and therefore camel's milk is a milk of a poor pig milk or something like that would be something which is not kosher. So the question that Gemara asks is, so why is honey from a bee kosher?
It comes from a
non-kosher species. So the Gemara gives two answers, which obviously has ramifications to every table on Rosh Hashanah when we eat honey. And that's, the Gemara says, one is that there's a kasav. The Gemara proves from various verses from Sukkim that no, this is an exception to the rule. That's one answer. A second answer is the honey is not really a secretion of the bee. It's something which the bee is just processing the nectar from the tree, from the flower. In other words, it takes in, doesn't really go into its system. It's in a sack, a honey sack, in the bee, and then it regurgitates the honey. It's not like a regular secretion that comes
From
the body itself.
It's just a it's really the nectar.
It's the nectar which goes through a holding pattern in the bee. Now, mm-hmm. granted that the saliva, which is a secretion of the bee, is used mm-hmm. in the enzymatic reaction to change it from nectar to honey, but
why isn't that a problem?
So Chazal weren't concerned about that. It's brought in, I believe, one of the commentaries. I think it's Pichadosh, touches on this. Talks about the Reich, and just touches on this point. But the bottom line is, they weren't concerned. Could be because it's such a small amount, it's
uh-huh.
bottle, even though it's maimed, which means it's a complicated halach issues. But the bottom line is they didn't care. So now that leads to the discussion of, well, that's only going to work by a bee. At least the halacha will say that it's only going to work by a bee because the bee has a special xeris hakasuv, the special pasuk, and the way it processes it is a special way, and therefore it's by a bee. But if you have other species, it might not work. Now, this is halacha Shulchan Aruch. We'd had a Yerodeya Tzim Pei Aleph addresses this other type of, what comes from other animals, such would be, I guess, it's black forest.
Right, so the black forest, I think it's also called honeydew honey. It's not really honey. That's the bottom line. It's just a secretion of an insect.
Recently about the coffee. You know, should we mention the coffee that's in the Andy Mountains? Where this coffee, which actually passes through the body of these cats, and it's collected.
What's it called again? There's a name for
it. It has a name.
Right.
And that civet, the cat is a civet. A civet is a non-kosher ingredient. But it's,
yeah, there's a certain coffee.
It's civet coffee.
And it's considered to be a delicacy.
Yeah. But it passes through the body entirely.
Right.
Through the digestive tract, etc.
I mean, it also gets involved with the question of the shellac, the question, but it also comes
Correct.
From an insect. We're not going to get involved
These
in that.
These coffee beans would not be kosher because they're mm-hmm. that's more of a...
Okay, so that's the basis for why honey is permitted. And then I see that you discuss here various additives that there might be in honey. Like, of course, we have the corn syrup question, which is basically a Passover.
Basically, Passover issue question. Year round. It's not really such a concern.
It's not a kosher issue so much. We do have Star K honey that is advertised as being mixed with corn syrup. Some of it comes in those little honeybees. Honey jars, you know, honey bears, I think they call them.
Mm-hmm. But I guess it's declared, technically it would be declared.
So we have a situation where it's declared, but sometimes it may not be declared. That's what you're addressing over here.
Exactly. I mean, this dates back. I have discovered something in working on the article. There's someone who wrote about this. His name was Sir John Hill. He lived in 1759, and he wrote several books. He was probably from the early... natural type of
mm-hmm.
items. And he wrote, as we quote, he speaks about the adulteration of honey in his day, where apparently they would add flour, which would be a chametz problem.
Do we ever come across that nowadays?
Not flour.
That's for historical...
But it was an interesting point that this has been going on for since before the American Revolution. They've been adulterating honey at times, and one has to be careful.
have to be careful. Yeah. If there are any questions, you can chat him via Dimdim, and we're happy to take your questions or your comments. So there are other products that the bee creates, like beeswax. And beeswax is not a problem. I mean, people don't really eat beeswax anyway.
Right, so more use it. There is a beeswax flavoring and things like that, but beeswax is not really, it's not fit for to be eaten, and therefore the halacha is it's not a problem. Even though technically it's a secretion, but the Paiskim say it's just a piece of wax, and
so it's not a food.
Not a food, right. Not a Michael. So there's no answer of eating it. Whereas two other parts of the bee, which are yaitzim and atame. I don't think it's something you would eat, you know, with your morning breakfast necessarily, but royal jelly.
Royal jelly, that's very popular in the health food
industry.
Correct.
So that is a non-kosher, yes, I mean a tamei, and the paiskim are not so fast to say that it's not roy lachila. In other words, like I say, it's not something you would sit down with a fork and knife and a spoon and eat a bowl of royal jelly. But lemaisa, it's yes, I mean a tamei, it's coming from an impure species, a non-kosher bee.
Right.
And it's a secretion, it doesn't have the Gemara Bechairis Heterim, which means what the Talmud,
right.
The reason the Talmud allows honey won't necessarily apply here, and therefore royal jelly is a problem, and even bee venom is something that is on the market.
So just when you get back to royal jelly before you move on, I see on the bottom over here in the footnotes you quote there are some authorities who allow bee jelly, and what's his thinking? Why is he?
I think it's because it's not raw. It's not something that people eat.
It's not a food.
It's not a Michael. It's not really meant to be eaten. It's a health remedy,
okay.
Etc.
So if a person really needed this or felt he needed it, they could ask their rabbi.
Right, correct.
Ask their rabbi for a final resolution. Now over here on page 3, they actually have they put in a picture when I went to a...
That's a picture of Rabbi Goldberg doing his work at a bee facility, dressed up, and
we
look good.
We have a bee apiary, they're called, and we certify them. And when I went there, I wanted to get really into the process to really see how it's done. I didn't really need to do this, and she said that none of her visitors, she has lots of visitors, nobody asked her this, to suit up and to go into the actual process and go with her to the bees and watch her take out the combs from the hives and to go through the whole process. But I felt that it would be good, A, because we're giving a certification to it and we should know exactly what happens at every level, and B, it's just amazing to see. I thought it would be something really special, and it really was something else. While we were suited up, so she starts taking out these... what they call them, the combs out of the box, and the bees start swarming around because they have nowhere to go. So she says to me, "You hear their buzzing?" I said, "Yes." She said, "Well, that's not a dangerous level yet. It's just they're a little bit nervous because their homes are being
invaded,
destroyed." But she said, if they get angry for some reason, then I'll let you know that, you know, then
so
the level goes up.
You run what it is supposed to be.
Yeah, you run because these suits, even though they protect you somewhat, they're not fully protective. If a bee really wants to get in, he could sting you. If they would swarm, then it could be So, but she was pretty familiar with it, so I felt comfortable. And then we went in. One thing that they have to do, which you mentioned in your article, is filter out the bee parts. Because people don't realize it, I didn't know this either, when you take out the honey, there's bees in the honey. You can't tell the bees, most of them leave, but some of them stick around the honey. So when you extract it through this spinning drum,
you're left with
some bee parts, bee parts, wax, honey, it's all mixed in together.
Right, but so you gotta filter it out.
So why is that not a problem?
So you filter
because they're going to filter it out. Right. So when they filter out the bee parts, the bees are left behind, and you're left...
There's a discussion, maybe, about what's left behind, because it's null and void, because it's...
You say over here that the bee parts impart a bad taste into the honey that...
To be shining and addressed.
Do not compromise the kosher status of the honey.
Right.
Okay, but we filter it out. She filters it out in our situation. I've never seen any...
Bee
parts in honey anyway. So it seems to be the filtering seems to be pretty well. One of the issues that we did look into was the barrels. The barrels come from various places, and are they reused? Are they not reused? The barrels where the honey is stored. That's something that that we we're interested in to find out and make sure that it's not a problem. Okay, what else is there to talk about with bees, Rabbi Heber? Any other kosher issues? You do mention at the beginning about the difference between orange honey and orange flavored honey.
Right, correct. Orange flavored honey, orange honey would be coming from the orange groves, so they're just regular honey. Orange flavored honey would be a flavored product, and we always say that flavored products typically require a kosher certification.
So the orange is coming from orange, where the bees.
That's where they're collecting the nectar.
The nectar from orange trees.
Those plants.
And there's actually this particular supplier sells all sorts of varietal honey, like echinacea honey,
mm-hmm.
I think broccoli honey, sorts of strange and unique types. But there's no flavor that's added to it, just that the bees are going to those, and they have a different flavor. It doesn't taste like echinacea, it doesn't taste like broccoli, it tastes like honey,
mm-hmm.
but each one has a certain color and flavor, and it's, in the wonders of God's creations, it's really something really special. Okay, Rabbi Heber, I want to thank you very much for joining us. If there are any questions, you can chat them now to Rabbi Heber. Otherwise, we're going to move on to our next topic, which is the use of honey and other simanim on Rosh Hashanah. Thanks again, Rabbi Heber.
Thank you very much for having me.
And we'll okay. Thank you very much.
To you and all your listeners.
Thanks.
And viewers.
Okay, we're going to have a double program today with one of our newest Kashrus administrators, who's sitting beside me now, Rabbi Moshe Shuchman, just recently joined the Star K. Welcome to the Star K, and welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me on the program.
Okay, it's our pleasure. And one of the things that we do here, we put Rabbi Shuchman right to work. He wrote an article for the Kashrus Currents. It's in this month. And by the way, you can get the Kashrus Currents in many ways. One is by subscribing to it, calling our office. We have a subscription available. The other is available free through various newspapers. The Hamodia, it comes in, I believe it was this week's or last week's Hamodia, and the Ateid this week's?
Last week's Monday.
Last week's. And this week's Jewish Press, it comes in the Jewish Press as well, some of them. And also the Ateid, and also... last but not least, we have it available online at our Star-K website, star-k.org website. You can get it there, and you can get it emailed to you. So it's available in so many different ways. We want to make sure that you have all the latest information. By the way, if you have any kosher questions right now, you can chat them to us. In general, you can reach us at 410-484-4110, or you can email us at star-k@star-k.org. And Zev, can we open up the phone lines for questions? Okay, we're going to open up the phone line. If you're joining us by telephone, you would be able to join us.
All callers are muted and may unmute themselves by pressing *6.
There you go. So if you have a question, feel free to chime in, press *6, and you can get unmuted and join us. So Rabbi Shuchman wrote an article, very nice article, about Rosh Hashanah and the simanim, and the signs, the symbolisms that we use on the new year to bring on good tidings or good happenings during the new year. Usually on Rosh Hashanah night, people sit down at the table and dip the apple in the honey.
Mm-hmm.
That's the one that everybody knows. And your article goes in through some of the sourcing and some of the different types of signs that we use. So what should we start with? Do you have any particular sign that you want to talk about?
Well, I think this is the topic in general is just a fascinating, it's a very interesting topic. It's something which does not fit the normal, the pattern of what we do in normative Judaism in halacha, to have just a ceremony where we do things and we say by doing these actions that would cause or engender a future result.
Mm-hmm.
This
and it's not a good deed that you do. You give tzedakah, you give charity. So you say, well, that charity will be a merit for whatever I need it for. But here, you're eating an apple, right? Dipped in honey. So how does that work?
Correct. Right.
Okay.
The halacha usually does not recognize empty ceremony. There has to be something, some viewed with meaning behind it. And certainly, when we say that we do something and that somehow that divines or portends a future result, that borders on a prohibition. The Torah has a prohibition of nichlush, of sorcery. We don't do things that say that by, like, say, for example, you know, in folklore, if a black cat crosses your path, so that portends a negative omen. So that's something which is prohibited in the Torah. So how can we say that by eating or partaking of certain simanim, certain foods at the beginning of the year, that that's a permissible practice?
Mm-hmm. I see you discussed that at the end of the article.
Yes, discussed at the end, but mm-hmm. I think that's really the...
You should start with that.
That's really the place to start. To understand in general mm-hmm. what we're doing here. There are really two major approaches that are advanced by the commentators. This is really a very old question. Already 1,100 years ago, the Gaonim, who lived in Iraq, in Babel, they were asked this question, how can it be that we eat foods at the beginning of the year and we say that portends a good omen?
Mm-hmm.
And there are two general approaches. One approach is maybe explained better by the Chai Adam. He was a rabbinical judge in Vilna about 220 years ago. And he says like this. He says, really, our decree in heaven for our coming year, it depends on our good deeds, it depends on the charity that we do, it depends on how well we follow the rules of the Torah. And if a decree in heaven says that we're going to have a good year, so it's like, you know, to give a parable, you know, if the high up level, the president, issues an executive decree, so how that filters out to the bottom level, whether it's actually fulfilled, that, you know, there are many layers of bureaucracy to go through. So same thing in a heavenly decree. A person might have a decree for a good year, but whether that's actually how it's going to play out, that requires to be solidified somehow.
Okay.
So there's an idea that we find this in the prophets. You know, the prophet Yechezkel, Ezekiel, we find that he played out certain prophecies, that
right.
by playing something out in the world of action, that someone mm-hmm. solidifies the good mm-hmm. decree for the coming year. So that's one approach to the Simana, and that really, we're not saying that by eating this apple and honey, we're going to have a sweet year. That's not what influences the sweet year. The sweet year is decreed based on our deeds, whether or not we do teshuva,
mm-hmm.
we feel remorse for the misdeeds that we did the previous year. But once that good decree is issued in heaven, so we solidify it, it somehow cements it,
mm-hmm.
that we do a physical act down here to cement it for the coming year. That's one approach.
Uh-huh. The approach, I appreciate that, that's very interesting. The one that I've always concentrated on is the one you mentioned here as a second, based on the Meiri, that really it's the fruits are just inspiring us to bring us to a level to pray harder, to daven harder, that the main aspect of it is the prayer that accompanies each sign. And when we say that we should have a sweet year, that's the main point. It's really the apple is just to, I mean, we could sit down and say 10 prayers, but it's not inspiring any more than the rest of the prayers. So this way, you know, it gives us something to focus on, and the kids get into it, and the adults mm-hmm. can focus on it more. Each prayer is separate and joined by its own fruit or its own sign. And so that inspires us to pray harder.
I think you're right. That's the more conventional approach.
Yeah, that's
the more rational approach
okay.
that we can understand. But the truth is that this idea of the prayer that accompanies each siman, that's, you know, in the terms of Jewish halacha, that's a relatively recent innovation. The Talmud, which mentions eating the simanim on the night of Rosh Hashanah, makes no mention of saying prayers in conjunction with the siman.
I see. Uh-huh.
The Talmud says, eating or gazing mm-hmm. at these siman at the beginning of the year, that alone will invoke the properties of the siman. But it's true, throughout the years, let's say the past 1,000 years, we find sources that mention prayers that go in conjunction with the siman, and that's true, that's what they say, that really the main thing is the prayer.
Mm-hmm.
And we're just using the siman as a way to inspire us to pray harder. We're using something which somehow evokes or is reminiscent of the prayer that we are about to say. So, as you said, the Meiri says the main thing is to do teshuva. The main thing is to inspire ourselves to improve our deeds throughout the coming year, and to pray to Hashem that our good deeds should be accepted. And the siman accompanies that.
Right. Now, Rick in Columbus has an interesting question. Let's deal with this. How is it that Sephardim also have carrots as one of the simon and the signs. The connection for Ashkenazim, Ashkenazic Jews, is that the Yiddish word for carrots is merin, and merin also means more in Yiddish. So we want to have more good throughout the year. But Sephardim had no connection with Yiddish. Okay, so let's explain the background for this question. The background is that not only do we use signs that are mentioned in the Talmud, but we also have added throughout the centuries signs that have connections with words like carrots, which is merin in Yiddish, means more, so that's a sign that was a simon that was picked up throughout the ages. So he's asking a good question, but the Sephardim don't speak Yiddish and didn't live in Yiddish-speaking countries, so what happened over there? Was it just that they picked it up from the Ashkenazic brethren, which wouldn't be so bad? But right. Is that what happened, or is there some other reason that those of Sephardic heritage are eating carrots?
Well, I would say that first we should issue a disclaimer that neither of us is Sephardi, so it's difficult for us to speak on behalf of the Sephardim. That said, I would say that the Sephardim, the idea of having something which is merin, more connection with that word, comes from the Talmud itself, which has one of the simonim called ruvia. Ruvia also means more, or right. Increasing or abundant.
Right. In Hebrew.
In Hebrew. Now right. The problem is, of all the five simonim mentioned in the Talmud, that simon called ruvia is the hardest one to identify. And the range goes from sesame seeds to fenugreek to some sorts of shamrock or clover.
Mm-hmm.
And now, since it's been so hard to identify it, or even if we could identify what it is, that specific identification was unavailable in certain parts of the world, so therefore...
It's possible it's carrot. Is that what you're saying?
I don't think it's possible that the rubia means carrot, but I think that we try to take the idea of rubia. Rubia means increasing or more, so in certain locations in the world, they took a food item whose word somehow relates to more or abundance. So in Eastern Europe, they chose carrots, because in Yiddish, the word for carrot is merin, and that's reminiscent of mer or more.
Okay.
And therefore, they said that is the way we fulfill the sin of rubia.
Right.
Now, the Sephardim today, I think traditionally, the Sephardim used beans, or small beans.
Black-eyed
beans.
Beans
right, for the sin of rubia. And we find that Sephardim today are using carrots. It's probably because, you know, in America, we have had this amalgamation of the Sephardim and Ashkenazim together. We went to Ashkenazi schools. Everyone's taught the same way in school,
uh-huh.
So the kids come home with their little card that they make uh-huh. in preschool and says carrot on the card.
Right. That's what I would have thought too, that they picked it up from us. But I just have to have a note on your disclaimer, is that I am half Sephardi. My grandparents on my mother's side came from Syria.
Oh.
So some of these Syrian signs, Sephardic signs, I did use. And many of the Sephardic customs, when we used to have my grandparents over at my house, they would do the Sephardic ones, and on Passover we did some of the Sephardic customs. So I do have some history with that. Of course, I don't remember the ones that they did, but all I remember now is the ones in the art school. But okay, so let's see some of the other signs that we have. I noticed some of the unusual ones here. You mentioned jellyfish.
Mm-hmm.
Using jellyfish.
Sure.
And yeah. I thought I came up with that in my house. But I guess there must be others who use jellyfish instead of real heads of fish.
Sure.
Okay, so explicitly, what's the background for that? What would the jellyfish do for you?
Right. First of all, fish is not one of the simonim mentioned in the Talmud. It's one that was added on later. And fish just traditionally are always symbolic of something good. They propagate. They're abundant. So therefore, already 1,000 years ago, the Rishonim, the Torah, the early commentators mentioned taking fish as one of the simonim, as a sin of Puru Revu, of having many children. And so that became used as a simon. It seems that maybe in the later generations in America, people don't have such an appetite for bringing fish to the table like they used to in previous generations. So if you go like the Meiri, that the idea of looking at the simen and that somehow inspires us to pray for the thing that we're mm-hmm. that's associated with that simen. So if we don't want to bring actual fish to the table or eat the actual fish, so we bring these candies in the shape of a fish And that would inspire us to pray mm-hmm. for the thing that the fish represents.
Right. So was the simin to eat the head of the fish, which I know is part of the simin,
mm-hmm.
or is the simin just to eat fish?
I think these are two separate ideas.
Two separate? So why can't we use gefilte fish? Most people have gefilte fish. You know, after they finish their simanim, they go on to the gefilte fish. Why don't they use that as a simin?
Okay.
That's what you do?
I think some people do.
Okay. They don't need to have like a whole... raw fish or something on the table.
That's probably the traditional way to have the raw fish on the table.
I see, okay. So using the heads of the jellyfish, that's what we do in my home because my kids haven't got too much appetite for the heads of the fish or the heads of the lamb or something like that.
Well, that the real simin is to use the head of the lamb.
Head of the lamb.
Because that should be mm-hmm. a head, not a tail, and also that it should be a reminder of that Akedat Yitzchak, which took place in Rosh Hashanah, which happened with the ram. Avram Avinu offered the ram instead of Yitzchak. That's also a very ancient simon, to use the head of a ram.
Right. By the way, it could be also an issue with when using the head of a fish with the worms inside. Right? There's been a general concern about worms in fish, which we have discussed on previous occasion, but especially in the heads of fish, there are always alerts out, and you want to be careful with that and look into that before you ingest. Let's take a couple more things, before we conclude. You discuss when the simonim should be served. Personally, I have them on the first two nights, but there are those who have them at all four meals as well, right? You mentioned that.
There are some people that have it at all four meals.
Mm-hmm.
This really depends on a personal practice, a personal custom that you have in your family. It seems to me, just looking at the common custom that's done today, is that to have them the first night for sure, that's mm-hmm. when they're brought to the table. And many of the cousins are bringing it on the second night of Rosh Hashanah as well.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen anybody that, I haven't met anybody that actually brings them during the daytime meals. But the main custom is the first night, and some people also use it during the second night as well.
Okay, Rick is saying the jellyfish are neither fish nor kosher. Are you referring to the jellied candies in the shape of fish? I'm sorry, we should have specified. Yes, we're referring to jellied candies, candy that is sweet, that is available in many different from companies like Pashkes and Liebers and all sorts of different kosher forms, that is just a reminder of what it looks sort of like a fish. So that's what we mean when we say jellyfish. You're correct that the jellyfish would not be the jellyfish that found on the ocean by the beach.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you would want to eat them anyway. But even if you would, they are not acceptable in a kosher home.
I think a person has to remember if they use the candy jellyfish, they should make a bracha of a shahakal before eating them.
You have to make a shahakal, right? Because they are candy and they're not a part of the regular meal. Like if you have them for dessert, you would make a brachos. If you have them prior to the meal, you'd also make a blessing on them. And you do end off here with the famous Mishnah Berurah that just like we should avoid sour foods and we want to have everything to give us a good taste and a good sign for the year, we should all the more so be careful of not getting angry during this period of time, because that will certainly be a bad simin, a bad sign for the year.
It was pointed out to me yesterday that in consistent with this, if someone comes to the table on the night of Rosh Hashanah and is waiting to go through the whole regimen of the simanim, mm-hmm. and he's looking forward to this and he wants to follow everything that's in the masar, and he sees that one was not on the table, that maybe the one who did the purchasing for the house inadvertently left that one out. So that is a very good opportunity to not be particular about it, to let it slide, to be happy about it with what you have, mm-hmm. and that's the best simon.
That's the best simon. Very good. Because that will show that you are forgiving, and God in turn will forgive you. Right? Because it says that any person who is in a forgiving mode especially during Rosh Hashanah time, God will in turn, as a mida k'neged mida, as a response to that, will give you yourself a forgiveness from high. That's what this is all about, essentially.
Well, especially at the beginning of the year, that these nascent moments of the year, the way we conduct mm-hmm. ourselves during the first day or two of the year, the first week of the year, that really sets the tone for the entire year. So you want to be in a good mood, a happy comportment, and that should really be you know, that should be a sign for mm-hmm. how the entire year should unfold.
Okay, I think we will close it out here, unless we have some more questions, or if you have any kosher questions at all, we'll take them now. You can chat them if you want to talk about anything that we could address in the next couple minutes. Rick is asking, what about the use of horseradish with its sharp taste on gefilte fish, or baking the gefilte fish with salsa? Well, that is also dependent on personal custom. In my home, we have a custom. We don't use horseradish on Rosh Hashanah. And I think that's the custom in many homes. Mm-hmm. Many homes would have that custom. I don't think we could say that it's forbidden to eat horseradish as if it was non-kosher, but most people, I'd say, have that custom. The question would be then, how long does that custom go? Some people would only have that on Rosh Hashanah. Some people continue it throughout the High Holy Days and even until through the end of Sukkot.
Mm-hmm.
And many people have that custom, and they dip, by the same token, they dip the challah in the honey all throughout Sukkot as well. I think those customs would go together. Baking the gefilte fish with salsa, I guess that would depend what it tastes like at the end. Is it sharp? Is it not sharp? Is it, you know, depends what kind of taste you are getting. If it has a sharp, like vinegary taste, then that would be something that many would not use. Let me just mention that this class and all our classes are videotaped and are available online at kosherclasses.org, kosherclasses.org, and you can go there and get this classes and our previous ones. Our master technician, Reb Zev Steen, takes the classes and puts them up there and runs the whole show here, and we want to thank him very much. And okay, if there aren't any other questions, we'll thank you very much for joining us. Thank you, Rabbi Shuchman, for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Zev, again. And next class is usually the last Wednesday of every month. This month and the previous one, we had to change it due to scheduling problems. But in general, we try to have it the last Wednesday of each month at 12 noon Eastern. If you'd like to get emails of when these classes are going to be held, sign up for our alerts, and you'll be informed of this class and all the other information that we have to offer. Thanks very much for joining us, and we want to wish everybody a sweet new year, 5771. Take care.
See you next time.
Be well.